WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and for $30 you can buy a Planet Money t-shirt with a squirrel holding a martini glass. But it's not a pledge drive thank you gift, it's journalism. NPR's Planet Money decided to manufacture a regular old shirt in order to understand the global economy and what actually goes into making the clothes we wear. It took them, as you may have been hearing on air all week, to a cotton farm in Mississippi, yarn spinning factories in Indonesia, garment factories in Colombia and Bangladesh, to the port in Miami, and finally to their offices here in New York. Maybe you've been hearing these stories about the T-shirt. They've been on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And joining us now is the executive producer of the T-shirt Project, a founder of Planet Money, and a producer for This American Life, Alex Blumberg. Hi, Alex. Welcome back to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Hey, Brian. Great to be here.
And listeners, if you have any questions about how a T-shirt is made or about any of the amazing Planet Money stories that you've been hearing on the radio all week, call us up, 212-433-9692. This incredible piece of journalism has probably left you with some follow-up questions, so you can ask the executive producer of this series, Alex Blumberg, from Planet Money, 212-433-9692. They made a T-shirt, and we learned so much. And I want to start in Mississippi, where the cotton that you use for the shirt is farmed. At just that one farm, they produce enough cotton in 1 year for 9 million T-shirts, you reported. That's a shirt for every New Yorker. Oh, my God.
It's true. It's true. And this is the story, I think, of American farming that I certainly didn't fully realize before we started working on this project. First of all, I don't think, you know, America is the leading cotton exporter in the world. We export more cotton than any other country in the world, which was, I don't think a lot of people realize. I certainly didn't realize it. And the way we do it is that cotton farming in particular is an incredibly high-tech, incredibly capital-intensive process here in the United States.
There were basically a lot of machines and almost no human beings involved, right?
Way more machines than people, absolutely. And the machines are sort of like these amazing, huge things. There's like, you know, that's the size of, you know, of a houseboat, these cotton pickers that can harvest 6 rows of cotton at a time. And there's a driver, but the driver doesn't really even have to touch the steering wheel. In fact, often they don't. There's sensors at the bottom that sense where the plants are and sort of pick them automatically. And one person driving one of these machines can harvest, you know, more than, you know, entire, you know, teams of people could have harvested in, you know, in years past.
And how ironic that once it was the heart of the slave economy in the United States, all those slaves picking cotton and working in those fields. Now, at this farm where you say they make enough cotton for they grow enough cotton for 9 million T-shirts, 26 machines and just 13 employees.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's really and yeah, it's quite a it's quite a feat to behold. And I think it's – but that's sort of the story in general of manufacturing and certainly the story that we found with the T-shirt is that there's – you know, you think there is a period in the T-shirt's creation where there's lots and lots of people involved. But for most of the journey, it's way more machines than people.
So it turns out to be cheaper, as we learned from your piece, to, after you grow the cotton in the United States, to ship it to places like Indonesia or Bangladesh or Colombia, have the T-shirt made there, then import it back into the United States. Tell us about the next stop.
So the next stop, so it was a little complicated because our T-shirts, we had a men's T-shirt and a women's T-shirt, and the men's T-shirt followed one path and the women's T-shirt followed another path. We made more men's T-shirts than women's T-shirts, so let's just follow that. So the men's T-shirts, the cotton, as clear as we could tell, came from the United States. I say it's a little hard to tell because sort of asking where the farm for the cotton in your T-shirt was is a little bit like asking, you know, the gas station, hey, which oil drill did this gas come from? You know, it's not, it's a sort of a global market and, mm-hmm. and cotton gets mixed together. But as near as we can tell, most of the cotton in our shirt came from the U.S., probably the Delta region. It then went to Indonesia where it was spun into yarn. And yarn, forget the image you have of yarn. It's not like, you know, somebody knitting a sweater out of yarn. Yarn is sort of a technical term. It looks like we would probably call it thread. If you look at your T-shirt or your clothes that you're wearing, you see those little lines that are sort of like woven together. That's yarn. And yarn is then woven, or in the case of T-shirts, knitted into fabric that is then cut and sewn into the T-shirts. So the yarn spinning phase took place in Indonesia.
And then Colombia and Bangladesh for the manufacturing of the T-shirts, respectively,
yes.
The men's and the women's.
Yeah, the women's they had a slightly different thing. The women's the cotton went to Colombia, where it was everything was done at the same place. The cotton was spun into yarn, and then the yarn was knitted into fabric, and then the fabric was cut and sewn, all in Colombia. For the men's shirt, the yarn went from Indonesia to Bangladesh, and then it was turned into fabric.
So on the economics of that, Colombia has higher wages, you reported, but no mm-hmm. tariff because we have a free trade agreement. Bangladesh is very, very cheap. Does it even out, or does Colombia offer something specifically that makes it worth paying the higher wage?
Well, Colombia has is more efficient. Like you know, sort of. This was another thing that surprised me is when you think of efficiency, it's sort of this abstract word. But we went with people who worked at Jockey. Jockey was the company that helped us make these T-shirts, we went with a manager from Jockey who said that you can literally hear the difference between a super efficient factory and a factory that's not that efficient. There's people, the people are a little bit more skilled in their hand movements. They can sew much more quickly. It doesn't take as many people per line to produce as many T-shirts. So in Colombia, they're much more efficient. It takes far fewer people, less time to produce more shirts than it does in Bangladesh.
Listeners, any questions for Alex Blumberg, executive producer of the Planet Money Makes a T-Shirt series that you've probably been hearing on the station this week? We'll take your calls in a minute. You can call in right now, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And in the meantime, I want to play a clip from one of the pieces in the T-Shirt series. This is from Marianne McCune, a great reporter who used to work here. She went to Colombia, where the women's shirts were being produced, and she talked to the CEO of the manufacturing company there. And you'll hear her refer in this clip to a worker named Morales.
There is a saying that is going to sound horrible, but our industry follows poverty.
Our industry follows poverty. Luis Restrepo is Morales's boss's 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 boss, or something like that. He's the CEO of all the factories we visited here.
Our industry is like on roller skates. First, it was Latin America, then it moved to China. Now China is becoming more expensive. It moved to Bangladesh or moved to Vietnam, and it goes like this.
Rolling toward the lowest paid workers.
So, Alex Blumberg, it follows poverty. Do you learn from this project, following a T-shirt, the kind of most disheartening, dispiriting thing that you could possibly have learned, that it's a race to the bottom to make the clothing that we wear in the United States, or at least a good deal of the clothing that we wear in the United States, as you followed its manufacture around the world?
That is absolutely the case that the garment industry traditionally has moved from one low wage country to the next, and as sort of like they refer to new countries coming online, and then sort of taking the business, and there is no question that And right now, the lowest wage country in the world that makes our clothes is probably Bangladesh. The minimum wage there is lower than any other garment making country almost, and that's even with the very, very recent rise in the minimum wage there. It's still near the bottom, and that's absolutely the case. There's a I don't want to call it a flip side, because I don't want to minimize the clear tragic ramifications of a huge desperate population, you know, and the ability that they have to be taken advantage of by fast-moving sort of global corporations. There is another side to it, though, that we did see, which is – so you, let's take Bangladesh, for example. Bangladesh, there are 4 million people working in the garment industry, 4 million people who are taking a sort of low-wage, monotonous, hard job. And we sort of were looking at why, what is driving them to do that. And so many of these people that are working in the garment industry have come from lives of extreme rural poverty that is in many ways much worse. You know, there's the, you know, people are just a step away from starvation. We talked to two of the workers that we profiled in Bangladesh. They'd lost 3 siblings when they were young, because the family couldn't afford medical care. There was like malnourishment issues. They remember their parents skipping meals so that the kids could eat. And it's that sort of desperation level living that makes a incredibly poorly paid garment industry job that by Western standards seems, you know, horrible. It's a step up in comparison.
And I guess that was one of the most morally mind scrambling facets of the series that I heard, the report from Bangladesh, where one of your colleagues reported on these two sisters who were making a few dollars a day or whatever it was in this garment factory, and yet they were sending money home to support their relatives who were back in the rural area, because they could do so and they couldn't have done that by living back there.
And the relatives back home were benefiting enormously by that money that they were sending home. They upgraded their house. They had lived in a straw house. They upgraded to a brick house. It had been a situation where they were not able really to get meat or fish in their diet, and now because of this money coming home, they were. And it's, you get into a situation where it's like you don't want to say, and therefore that excuses all the horrible things that go along with garment industry moving into these low-wage countries, and it doesn't at all. And it doesn't sort of absolve anybody of the responsibility that we have as wearers of the clothes that are being made to be aware of conditions like the conditions that produced the factory collapse at Rana Plaza. But it is just part of the complicated reality. The garment industry jobs, when we were there, those are good jobs in Bangladesh. People want those jobs by and large. At the same time, there are huge strikes right now in Dhaka because they're not paying enough to live on. If that's what you're – if you're the sole earner in a family, you're not making enough to live on having a job in a garment industry.
Well, we have all kinds of your Planet Money listeners calling in, filling up our board. So let's talk to a few. Jacob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Alex Bloomberg. Hi, Jacob.
Hi there.
Hi.
You guys mentioned that in the U.S., machinery is taking over a lot of the human jobs. And I was wondering if that's the case overseas as well. You also talked about how workers are physically sewing these T-shirts. And I'm wondering what the, you know, human-to-machine labor ratio is like overseas.
It is definitely the case overseas as well. I think that is a global trend, that machinery is replacing human labor in a lot of instances. It just so happens that sewing clothes together right now is still cheaper to do with people than it is to do with machines. The machines are hard to make and they're expensive, and I don't think they quite even have technology that can sort of sew clothes together as well and as quickly as humans can. Most people will tell you that's probably going to change soon. I mean, soon, in the next couple of years or decades.
And so are there countries in which, if you've reported on this, garment manufacturing has lifted people out of poverty and grown a middle class?
Well, there is definitely an association with textiles and apparel and moving up the economic ladder. So there are many, many countries that have gone through a process where garments and textiles were a huge part of the economy and helped import sort of skills and investment that then enabled those countries to sort of move up the economic ladder. I mean, certainly Korea, Japan, China have all gone through a textile and apparel phase that it was associated with economic growth. And in Bangladesh as well, you know, there has been a sort of a massive reduction in poverty. The garment industry has some role in that, certainly. Nobody would say it's all about that.
And we see garment factories leaving Colombia now, as you reported, because the wages are getting too high. But I guess it is yet to be seen whether that means that some other kind of manufacturing will come in and replace the garment manufacturing, and it will become more of a middle-class country. Something like that happened in South Korea, I think. Or whether it will just kind of lose its job space and people will wallow back down into more poverty.
Well, I mean, and definitely this has happened throughout history. It happened in if you go back in history, it happened in England. It happened in the United States. Like, as the economy grows larger, as wages rise, people climb up into the middle class. And that is definitely something that has happened in those other countries as well, South Korea, Japan, China. You know, there is always dislocation, though, at the moment where the last factory closes, the workers lose their jobs. And are those particular individuals going to be able to transition into the new economy? That's always the struggle. And that's a struggle that we fight here in the United States. And that's a struggle that is going to be happening in Colombia. And then on top of that, there are, you know, you can worry about, like, are there fundamental changes to economic growth that are happening due to mechanization and stuff like that? And that the jury is still way out on that.
Let's take another call. Is it Nicheza? Is that how you say your name in Brooklyn?
Hi, it's Nicheza.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I am the owner of a T-shirt company called T Revolutionary, and I sell T-shirts of my revolutionary heroes, just like, for an example, Nelson Mandela, of course. Uh-huh. For me, what I want to ask you is that I purchase my shirts from Alternative Apparel, and they talk about how they produce their shirts overseas, but they do it ethically, and they make sure that no children are in the plants that they have partnerships with, and that they treat the workers, you know, properly. So I was just wondering, it's kind of like a balance between how to have shirts that are produced this way but that are still affordable for a small T-shirt company like myself. And I was wondering if you knew of the different T-shirt companies that sell wholesale, for instance, Hanes or Gildan, Alternative Apparel, if you knew the differences that they use, which ones are the best ones.
I can't comment on specific. I don't know enough to comment on specific companies and their practices. I do know, however, that as we were reporting this project, we talked to, you know, we approached many different companies, and some didn't want to have anything to do with us, and some, you know, welcomed us into the process, you know. So I'm assuming that Jockey was willing to work with us because they feel very, very comfortable in their ethical, you know, in their sourcing. And they told us, and everything we could do sort of verified this, that they take it very seriously. They try to be, they try to vet. They talk to a lot of factories in Bangladesh, talk to a lot of owners. And there's something called RAP certification that you can look at. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there are people who will say that's not necessarily the best way of judging, but there's no perfect way of judging. There are, I think, though, you will find there are companies that do try to really take it seriously, and other companies that don't think about it as much.
Nicheza, thank you very much. And here's a question on our comments page at WNYC.org from a listener named Julie, who says, please get your Planet Money person to talk about the massive U.S. government subsidies that make the U.S. cotton industry so competitive that it drowns the African producers' ability to compete on the global market. You will know that this is a big issue in front of the World Trade Organization and has been for some years. Is it cause of real concern in a world where African poverty impacts us all and Africans want to trade their way out of poverty, not receive aid? Are you familiar with that whole dynamic that Julie refers to?
Yeah, I'm very familiar with it, and that is a dynamic that has been well reported and is absolutely the case. The United States government definitely subsidizes our cotton farmers in a myriad of ways, you know, not least of which we, you know, we send money directly to cotton farmers. We also help them do the thing that that we also sort of remove one of the oldest risks there is to farming, which is risk. So we subsidize insurance. So cotton farmers in the United States, and many farmers, soybean farmers as well, you know, and there's corn farmers. They have a menu of cheap subsidized insurance that they can choose from that will help them mitigate all these risks. And, you know, they live in the United States. The United States does, you know, has all sorts of technology and research that, that it subsidizes as well. None of this is, you know, African farmers have none of this. And the one thing that African farmers can compete on is price. But because we are subsidizing our cotton producers, they are able to produce a very, very high quality product at a much lower price probably than they would be able to produce it otherwise. So there's definitely this dynamic where we are helping our own farmers, and the because of all the global dynamics, it is hurting farmers in Africa.
For those who think that the United States is the one out there pushing free trade around the world in all cases. Let's take one more question, and it's going to be from Kat in Queens, and it's probably the one everybody's thinking about. Hi, Kat. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Can you hear me?
You bet.
Okay. So I've got two really heavy questions. One is on iconography, which is why a squirrel? Why with a cocktail? And the second is, so how do I buy it?
Wow. Those are so the why a squirrel? A squirrel, there's the simplest answer is there's a visual pun. There's a famous phrase from economist John Maynard Keynes where he refers to animal spirits as sort of a part of the way that emotions interact with the economy. Animal spirits, I think I'll just leave it to you to figure out how that pun works. And then you can buy it by going to npr.org/shirt, npr.org/shirt. There's a site that we made that shows, you know, where you meet all the people who made the shirt and you meet the cotton farmers, and it sort of takes you on the whole journey. And there's a button there. If you click on the chapter menu, there's a button that says buy a shirt.
But why $30 each? I could probably walk up and down, I don't know, 181st Street or something like that and buy T-shirts for a tenth of that. How much did you end up paying for your shirts?
We ended up – so we broke down the cost on the website for the men's shirt. We ended up paying for – so the first round of shirts we raised through Kickstarter. So when you include Kickstarter fees and Amazon.com fees and everything like that, we ended up paying – I think it was almost $13 in raw costs for the shirt. And then we sold it for $25 on Kickstarter. And then we didn't make any money in terms of like – we sent everybody around all over the world to report on it. So we ended up not making really very much money at all on that shirt. And this one, I think, you know, the cost will be somewhat similar in terms of getting them shipped out to people, getting them printed, getting them the raw costs to Jockey to get them printed.
So you're going to make money. Now, you're a not-for-profit public radio show. Just want to be very clear. When you say you didn't make any money on your $25, what's your goal here?
The goal is the same thing that, you know, public radio is always trying to do is like if there's a way to bring in money, I think we would like to bring in money.
All right.
Yes, and if we can do that by you know, it's like, I think you can think of it as a pledge premium.
Think of it as a pledge premium, as a thank you gift.
A very attractively priced pledge premium, I might add.
And attractive to wear pledge premium, I might add. And not to mention the conversations that will start about the amazing investigative series that they have done on Planet Money following a T-shirt from its inception as cotton being grown in the south of the United States all the way around the world and then back to your back. So Alex Bloomberg, executive producer of the series, thank you so much.
Thank you.